Welcome to lectionary lunch for the first Sunday after Christmas. We'll be looking at the Old Testament lesson, Exodus chapter 13, verses 1 to 3, and then 11 to 15. Starting with verse 1. Vayomer Yahweh el Moshe l'amor, pretty straightforward, not too much to comment upon here. Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, just a minor footnote, we always translate this word l'amor, saying, or Dr. Gibbs translates it legon, I know, but in any case, this is an infinitive construct in Hebrew with a lamed on the front, and the sense of the grammar is he spoke by way of saying. Yeah, this is a common, actually, grammatical function. We usually don't bother telling students this in first year Hebrew, just tell them to treat it like quotation marks. But actually, this same construction occurs in other places with verbs. He did something by doing something else. And that's why it comes to function as quotation marks. He spoke by saying as follows. Verse 2. Kadesh li kal bakor, we'll just take this in phrases, set aside for me every firstborn. The first word there, kadesh, an imperative from the verb kadosh, we usually translate be holy. Here, used in its more secular sense of simply setting something aside, consecrating it. Even that probably has a little too much of a theological overtone here. We should probably just go with the, with the simpler set aside. The next phrase, pether kol rekem bibnei Yisrael. We ended with set aside for me the firstborn, and it continues, the firstborn of all, of every womb among the sons of Israel. This phrase, pether al rechem, the firstborn of every womb, pether is less common than the word preceding it, bakor, as a word for firstborn, but it's appropriate here. The noun pether comes from the verb patar, meaning to divide or to open something. And the pether is the first thing that opens the womb, the first one to open the womb. So here in this phrase, pether al rechem, the firstborn of every womb, this is a good word choice to go along with bakor here. The next phrase, ba'adam v'ba'behema lihu, among the man, literally, and among the animal, to me is he. Here, note the definite article among man and the animal. Here's a case where the word Adam clearly must refer to all of mankind and not merely to males. This is not a matter of gender neutrality or political correctness. Males don't have wombs, so Adam can't be male here. It must refer to mankind, and probably that's reinforced by the definite article, the man and the animal, meaning mankind and animal kind. So here probably that's evident in more than one way. We'd be quite appropriate here to translate people for Adam in this case. We wouldn't be simply being politically correct if we chose to translate it that way. As a matter of theological significance, it's perhaps worth noting that this last phrase, lihu, to me is it. God is not asking Israel to give them something. He is claiming that which is already his. And that probably helps us to understand the biblical concept of stewardship a little better. We're not giving God something. We're simply recognizing what is already God's, and the fact that we are merely temporary stewards of the things that are God's. So God isn't asking Israel to give it to him. He's simply reminding them that it's already his, and he wants that which is his. Verse 3. Vayomer Moshe el Ha'am, then Moses said to the people, passing the message on, Zakor et Hayom Hazeh, remember this day. Here, this word Zakor is technically a call infinitive absolute, being used as an imperative. You may remember one of the uses of the infinitive absolute in Hebrew is that it can be something of a wild card that can stand in for other forms of the verb. It most commonly does that for the imperative. As also in Exodus 28 in the Ten Commandments, remember the Sabbath day, Zakor eth Yom HaShabbat. Remember the Sabbath day, an infinitive absolute there. In fact, there are 8 occurrences of the infinitive absolute of this word in the Old Testament. 5 of them are substitutes for the imperative, 5 of the 8. The imperative is also used. It's used 48 times. So it's not as though they didn't use the imperative, but you know, the use of the infinitive absolute as an imperative is pretty common. Well, carrying on then. Remember this day, Asher Yitzathim Mitzrayim Mibeth Avadim, of which you came from Egypt from the house of slaves. You came out from Egypt from the house of slaves. Here there are a couple of textual notes that are at least worth mentioning. They might help us to recognize some of the issues in translating as well. Footnote A on the verb yitzathim, you came out. A number of texts, the Samaritan Pentateuch, the Septuagint, the Syriac, and the Vulgate, all add the equivalent of bo on it. Remember in Hebrew, we have no way of saying on which. You can't add a preposition to this indeclinable particle of share. So Hebrew normally adds what we call a resumptive pronoun at the end to give you, in effect, the case you should understand with a share. And that's what these texts have done here. They in effect, add the resumptive pronoun, which we need in translation. In English, we have to be able to say, in which you, the day in which you came out from Egypt. Now, I suspect in this case that what we have here is probably an expansionist addition to the text, not something that was in the Masoretic text originally. The Samaritan Pentateuch is, of course, a dialect of Hebrew, so it's a Hebrew text, a Samaritan Hebrew text. All the others are translations, and they're probably simply translating what is the obvious and inevitable sense here. Mitzrayim, the footnote says, from the land of Egypt. That's probably simply a case of assimilation. The phrase, the land of Egypt, occurs 60 times in the book of Exodus. And probably, if land is left out here, the translators have just inserted it because they're so accustomed to seeing it. The phrase at the end, the house of slaves, occurs 3 times in the book of Exodus and a couple of other times elsewhere. It's always used in the Old Testament exclusively for referring to the period of bondage in Egypt. So this phrase always has a very specific referent. Usually most English translations, since the verb is pronounced plural, house of slaves, most English translations turn it into an abstraction and say house of slavery or house of bondage. But we should get a theological point here. We should be careful to recognize this is not in any strict sense a liberation. Certainly not in the modern sense. God is not setting Israel free to do whatever they want. In the Old Testament, the use of the language is very careful. God simply exchanges one form of servitude for another. Israel moves from the avodah in Egypt to the avodah of God. And the avodah of God is the worship that God should receive as the only true God. So this is, in some sense, not in the modern sense of the term, a liberation, but an exchange of one kind of bondage for another, you might say, as Paul says in the New Testament when he refers to himself as a slave of Christ, carrying on a very appropriate Old Testament idea. The last phrase here, Ki b'chozek yad chotze Yahweh efkim mizeh. Because, it's Ki introduces an explanatory clause, because by means of a strong hand Yahweh brought you out from there. Interesting contrast. I was thinking about this in the context of this being the first Sunday after Christmas and how in our generation we seem to be enamored of a God who is soft and gentle, especially at Christmas time. Now, the Old Testament is much more interested in a God who is powerful. And that should serve as a salutary reminder to us that at least in the Old Testament way of thinking, the doctrine of the omnipotence of God is a gospel doctrine. It underscores the fact that God has the power to deliver on his will. And this is in contrast to the gods of Canaan and Egypt in these pluralities of gods where no god is all-powerful. You know, whatever happens in the realm of the gods happens as a result of the conflict of the wills of the gods, and no god, not even the highest god, can get his way all the time. By contrast, the fact that Yahweh can get his way all the time means that he has the power to deliver. Other gods can promise, but they can't necessarily deliver. Yahweh can deliver because he has a strong hand. And so we shouldn't be ashamed of the power references with regard to God in the Bible. They're really ought to be seen as a source of comfort to us, of a God who can deliver on his promise. The rest of the verse goes on to take us into the discussion of the unleavened bread and the fact that Israel should observe the Passover in the month of Aviv, the first month in the calendar, in their calendar every year. So we move on to verse 11. Wahaya ki yibika Yahweh el eretz ha-hakananini. And it will come to pass, here with temporal phrase at the beginning, it will come to pass when Yahweh brings you to the land of the Canaanite. Singular, but we take it as a collective plural. Notice here, this ki is temporal, introduces a temporal clause. Ki in Hebrew is used to introduce about 10 different kinds of clauses. It's sort of a general purpose clause introducer. In this, we saw a moment ago, it introduced an explanatory clause, and we translated it because. Here it introduces, with haya, a temporal clause, we translate when here. So don't just think you can gloss and sort of see a Hebrew word, substitute an English word here. You have to look and say, what kind of clause is this that we have here? In this case, temporal. So we'd probably just translate when Yahweh will bring you or brings you to the land of the Canaanites. Ka'asher nishba laka la'avotheka, just as he swore to you and to your fathers. Wa'nathana lak. Now this is the tricky bit here, is that this wow goes back and picks up the temporal clause at the beginning of the verse. It doesn't continue the idea immediately preceding, which is what we would expect. And so this is a little tricky in terms of Hebrew syntax, a little more like Greek. Dr. Gibbs would be a little more comfortable with this. You get this kind of broken syntax. We don't like this in Hebrew.
Pleasantly complex.
Yeah, pleasantly complex syntax. But in this case, the trick to reading this correctly is to see that the wow here is outside this clause introduced by Kasher. The clause introduced by Kasher ends with the Masoretic punctuation, the Athnach. And the wow, the next clause, continues the narrative sequence of the preceding clause. When he will give it to you, then verse 12, the wow finishes the temporal clause begun at the beginning of verse 11. When that happens, then verse 12, then then you will give over all your firstborn of the womb to Yahweh. When he brings you into the land and gives it to you, then you shall literally, hifil here, cause to pass over into God's hand. You give it over, we probably say. Wakal pether sheger b'behema asher yihye laka. And every firstborn, here literally, this is a construct chain, literally, and every firstborn of an offspring of an animal. We'd probably simplify that and simply say every firstborn animal or something like that. This word sheger is actually kind of interesting here. This term has very specific cultic connections in the ancient Near East. It's the name of a god in Canaanite and Babylonian mythology, typically a god associated with cattle, and sometimes perhaps even a whole group of sort of herdsmen gods that are assistants to Baal in the Canaanite myths. So one is tempted here, perhaps, to bring in that idea that somehow Yahweh is here defeating these cattle gods by claiming the firstborn. I think that's probably a case of reading too much theology into etymology in this case. Whenever this word occurs in the Old Testament, it's simply used in its common noun sense. The only cultic connection is that these are offerings. There are never any overtones of deity connected with this word in the Old Testament. One always has to be careful of not over-theologizing etymology. We see this at Christmas time all the time. I can't tell you how many Christmas or Advent sermons I've heard over-theologizing the name Bethlehem. You know, house of bread, connecting it to Jesus feeding the 5,000 and Jesus as the bread of life. Well, if you're doing this etymologically, of course, Bethlehem etymologically means the place where there was a temple to the Canaanite god Lachmu. Beth is a location of a temple. So Beth Shemesh, a place where there was a temple to the sun god Shemesh or Shamshu. Beth Lechem originally meant the place where there was a house of the Canaanite god Lachmu, the bread god. And of course, that etymology has been long lost by the time you get to the New Testament, even by the time you get to the mainstream of the Old Testament. We don't read it that way any more than we read the fact that if we're talking on Thursday, we think of that as the day on which we worship the Norse god Thor. The etymology is not a source of theology. And many students and pastors sometimes lose track of the difference between etymology and theology. Here I just remind us that we need to be careful of that. Anyway, finishing this up, we have here actually a difficult phrase at the end of this. Hazakarim le-Yahweh, following at the end of this clause, and all the firstborn of the animals which Yahweh gave to you, the males to Yahweh. Now, the textual note tells us that a variety of texts, the Septuagint, the Targums, the Vulgate, add the equivalent of the Hebrew word, you shall set aside, you shall sanctify. And the problem is the grammar here is just tough. There needs to be we want a verb here. We could supply the verb to be, and the males will be to Yahweh. And that's what most English translations do. My sense, however, is actually, here's a case, again, of a little difficult syntax. We probably should go pick up the verb at the beginning of the verse. You shall cause to pass into the hands of Yahweh, the males. All the rest of this sort of is inserted in the middle. Or we might do this something like, specifically, the males. To Yahweh. But probably here the answer is not to do as some of the translations the Targums do, insert a verb that's not here, but rather see this connecting back to the verb at the beginning of the verse. And this variant arises because of this is a little clumsy syntactically. Verse 13, and every firstborn of the womb of a donkey you shall ransom with a sheep. Now, the oddity about this is the specificity of donkey. There is a footnote reference below B where the Syriac reads just animal instead of donkey. And in some ways that reading makes more sense in the context. I don't want to do a thing on textual criticism here. But there is a little problem, and the words donkey and animal are not so far off. Visually, we may have a mistake here, or it may be just that donkeys were so valuable as animals of burden that people would be tempted not to give them as offerings. And so God provides for that temptation by allowing them to ransom a sheep. But there's a theological point that flows from this, regardless of whether the word was originally donkey or animal here. The word for ransom, pada, is a legal term. In law in the Old Testament to buy out something, to recover something, to acquire something. It's used also of God in the Old Testament, God ransoming his people. It is a term, well, it's not an extremely common term, it's a term that is of theological significance in the Old Testament. Anyway, you shall, every firstborn of a donkey, you shall ransom with a sheep. And then the next clause, Wa'im lo tifde wa arafto. But if you will not ransom it, then you shall break its neck. Literally, you shall neck it. Araf, this is a denominative verb, a verb made from a noun. And usually that denominative verbs in Hebrew mean you will do something that's associated with the thing. And what you do associated with necks in this case is that you break them in killing animals. So that's why this verb comes to mean to break the neck. So if you will not ransom it, then you shall break its neck. Wakol bekor adam b'banecha tifdeh. And all the firstborn of man among your sons you shall ransom. Notice God doesn't give them the option of breaking the neck, although perhaps it was a temptation at times to some parents. In ancient Rome, of course, and Greece, it was quite common to dispose of children who were unwanted, firstborn or otherwise, under the Roman law pater familias. God does not allow his people to dispose of unwanted children either before birth or after. Well, that's not really part of the text, but it's a helpful reminder in any case. Wahayaki yishalka binka machar lemor. And it shall be when, another temporal clause like the one we just saw, it shall be when your son shall ask you tomorrow, saying. Interesting use of the word tomorrow here. There are only one of two places in the Old Testament where this word makar really means something like the future more generally. It almost always means literally tomorrow. And the only two places are here and in this almost exact same phrase in the same context in Deuteronomy chapter 6 verse 20. So tomorrow almost certainly in the context means in the future, because we're talking about more than one time in the future when this happens. And what does he ask? The next phrase, mazo, what is this? Vayamerta elau, then you shall say to him, b'chozek yachotzi Yahweh mimitzrayim mibeth avadim. With a strong hand, Yahweh brought us out from Egypt from the house of slaves. Verse 15, wihi ki hikshaparo lishal chenu. When Pharaoh, literally, I'll translate this quite woodenly here at first. When Pharaoh hardened to send us. Now, what does that mean? Either we have one of two things here. Either we have an object that's just simply understood, when Pharaoh hardened, parentheses, his heart, or else there is an idiom that occurs with other verbs in Hebrew, which means, in effect, to have a hard time doing something. He just had a hard time bringing himself to do it. And that's, since that's an idiomatic usage of the verb to harden that occurs in the Old Testament half a dozen times or so, I'm inclined to read it this way, rather than supply when Pharaoh hardened his heart, although that clearly is what happened. That's the referent in any case. You know, I'd translate this in a more modern way, sort of simply, when Pharaoh had such a hard time sending us away, he just couldn't bring himself to do it. Then, Yahweh kal bekor be'eretz mimitzrayim mivkor avam wa'ad bekor behema. Then Yahweh killed every firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of man even as far as the firstborn of animal. And we'd obviously smooth that out in translation if we were doing this for publication, but I wanted to take it in a fairly wooden way. Notice again the temporal clause at the beginning of the verse, then the second part of the temporal phrase is introduced simply by a wow in Hebrew in the second part. Al-Kain, ani zoveach le-Yahweh. Therefore, Al-Kain, ani zoveach. I am sacrificing to Yahweh. Here, we probably understand this as durative. That's why I do it, because Yahweh did what he did. Then the last phrase, kol peferechem ha-zekarim wa-kol bekor banai efdeh. All the firstborn of the womb of males. Two ways to read this phrase. Either read it as in a positive, all the firstborn of the womb, comma, the males. Or you could read this as an adjectival construct, all the firstborn of the womb of males. Either way would end up meaning all the males who are firstborn. Obviously, it couldn't be a possessive construct because, again, males don't have wombs. So it can't be the womb of the males, meaning nothing. So it's either an adjectival construct or an appositive. Either one would work in terms of morphology. And they both end up meaning the same thing. Wakalba korbanai efdeh, all the firstborn of my sons I ransom. So here we get maybe one of the ways we might preach this text, and that's the introduction of what we might think of as the theology of the great exchange, that God has exchanged the firstborn of Egypt to set free his own firstborn, ultimately as a type of the fact that he extends to exchange his own firstborn to set free all mankind. So in preaching this text, one could, I suppose, take the cue from the text and emphasize the redemptive aspect of God's strong hand in accomplishing salvation, or this typology of the great exchange that's implied here in the text as well, in which Christ, and maybe Christmas time, the typology of the great exchange is a more contextual way within the context of the church here of getting at the gospel from this text. I think one key to emphasize in either case is that the reality of our salvation depends on what God has done in history. Now, there's no spiritualizing Christianity here. We can't make the claim that what the Bible says about theology is true, but what it says about history isn't, because the whole typology of salvation depends upon what God has done in history, not just as Paul says in 1 Corinthians about Christ's resurrection, but also here in the Old Testament. So at Christmas time, we're particularly prone to this sort of spiritualizing Christianity tendency. And the text should at least remind us to root our proclamation of the gospel in God's acts in history. Well, thank you.